You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up, we'll learn about some of the most influential presidential primaries from Wisconsin's past. First, as other states around the Midwest have been putting resources into developing wind energy sources, Wisconsin has been slower to move. States like Iowa, Michigan, and Indiana have added thousands of megawatts of wind power over the past 5 years, while Wisconsin has gained just 17. But the state's wind energy lull could be ending, with two new possible wind farms on the horizon. Joining us now to talk more about Wisconsin's wind energy policy is Jim Tingem, a professor of engineering at UW-Madison. Jim, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Well, why haven't we seen more wind development in Wisconsin over the last 5 years or so?
We have a 10% renewable portfolio standard, and that was met approximately in 2012. So there has not been much of a utility need for additional renewable energy since about 2012.
So we met that, but you know, we look at other neighboring states, comparing ourselves against Minnesota, Iowa, Michigan, and Wisconsin seems to be lagging. What are other states doing?
Well, Iowa and Minnesota do have a little bit more abundant wind resources to use, and they also have a stronger political will and interest in going into renewables into the future, attracting manufacturing for renewables to the state, and then meeting future environmental and climate change initiatives from the federal government.
Is there anything besides having met this threshold for clean energy in Wisconsin that has been holding the state back from developing more wind energy?
Yes, it is difficult for developers here in Wisconsin due to some local standards that are more strict than state standards. So, you know, the state-based science is really what would drive more wind here, so the developers know what noise restrictions they need, what setbacks they need, and then that would not be overturned or an issue at more local levels is one of the biggest things holding back additional wind in Wisconsin.
You've been saying more state-based science. What kinds of questions do you think need to be answered?
Well, appropriate setbacks where health-based questions from neighbors, such as any health impacts that I would have, flicker, which is a when the blades kind of flutter the sunlight into your windows. So basic science in which those outcomes, what is really health-based versus what is an annoyance to a neighbor, or especially if a resident is opposed to the wind farm, what they perceive as a annoyance.
You're saying that maybe Wisconsin doesn't have those answers yet, but have other states worked on answering those questions? Is there science out there already that we could turn to?
Yes, many states have looked at this. Massachusetts did a very comprehensive health-based study that refuted many of these claims of health impacts. There have been large studies in Canada, in Australia, the United Kingdom. So around the country and the world, these basic science limits have been fairly well established on the benefits and the negatives of wind energy.
We're talking right now with engineering professor Jim Tingem, talking about Wisconsin's wind energy future. And it looks like this sort of lull that Wisconsin has had in wind energy could be ending, and the wind industry could be picking up with a few industrial-sized projects getting looked at in Wisconsin. What can you tell us about those?
Well, there are at least three projects that are reasonably close to development stage. One is the Highland Wind Farm in St. Croix County, where they have received a certificate of public convenience and necessity from the Public Service Commission, but that is in a legal appeal right now, and briefs are going back to the Public Service Commission on some noise abatement issues to readdress that issue there. Also in Lafayette County, there's an EDP wind farm that actually will likely go to construction next year, And then in Tish Mills, Wind, and Kewaunee and Manitowoc counties is possibly on the drawing boards in the future. So there's at least three wind farms that are in various stages right now of approval and towards construction in Wisconsin.
What can you tell us about the size of these proposed wind farms?
Well, the ones on the board right now are relatively small. As an example, in St. Croix County, that is a 102.5-megawatt project, which is about 50% smaller than, like, Blue Sky Greenfield in Fond du Lac. So they're moderately sized wind farms. But for perspective, a 100-megawatt wind farm is enough power for about 57,000 residential households.
Are there incentives that developers of wind farms are offering to get communities on board with what they want to do?
Well, there's always good neighbor policy. You want your landowners and your neighbors to feel good about your development. I know of certain wind farms in the Midwest where they offer things like free satellite cable, just in case you have any problems with your antennas near the farm. They will build better county roads towards the farm and other public infrastructure to help out the local economy. And then there's also going to be a reimbursement to those local levels of townships and counties for hosting fees, in addition to the money paid to the landowners for leasing their property for wind energy development.
Right, and looking more closely at that, is there evidence that the compensation and incentives that companies can give would make a difference in local economies?
Well, they do. In Wisconsin, it's close to $2 million in annual leases for property owners are already proffered, in addition to what's going to local school boards and the like. So those incentives are money going back into the economy. You know, another major incentive here in Wisconsin is the manufacturing base, such as Broadwind Towers in Manitowoc, which is a large producer of the towers for wind energy across North America.
And you mentioned earlier that Iowa seems to be a good place to have wind farms, that it is, it sounds as though the natural terrain lends itself. Do we have that in Wisconsin?
Well, what Iowa has going for it in part is that they have larger tracts of land under single ownership, so it's easier to site wind farms where you only have to negotiate with one or two larger landowners. In Wisconsin, it's a little bit more segmented, smaller, you know, 80 acres here, 160 acres here, so you do have to negotiate with a larger pool of landowners to site a large-scale wind farm in Wisconsin.
So as we said, there has been this five-year lull in development of wind energy. Now there's a few new projects on the horizon. Do you get the sense that things are shifting, that this is a turning point for Wisconsin in terms of wind energy development?
I really don't see a seismic shift. I see incremental movements until major regulatory drivers like the Clean Power Plan come home, and Wisconsin will have to react on certain percentages of renewable energy in the portfolio. So there may be a smattering of new projects in development, a trickle per se, but I do not see a torrent in the next several years.
And aside from that, do you think that enough questions have been answered or will be answered about health concerns about wind farms to make communities and people amenable to having them, hosting them in their towns?
Yes, actually, I believe that our Public Service Commission does a quite good job of addressing concerns when they're evaluating these sites. As an example, the proposed wind farm in St. Croix County was intensively reviewed, addressed, and all concerns were put on the table much more extensively than other states. So in the state, we do have a very good regulatory review of the benefits and negatives of wind energy development.
And just briefly as we wrap up, are we reaching a point, are we at the point where wind is a viable energy source, an alternative to coal or natural gas?
It is very viable right now. Wind energy is cost competitive with new coal or new nuclear. And we are just under 5% wind energy in the nation. Department of Energy projects that we could get to 20% by 2025 without major policy initiatives.
James, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
That was engineering professor Jim Tingem talking about Wisconsin's wind energy future. With today's presidential primary in full swing, we thought we'd take a look at some past Wisconsin primaries that turned out to be influential in the presidential election. Joining us now is Wisconsin Life producer Erica Janik and our WPR colleague Scott Gordon. Erica and Scott, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Well, Erica, we're going to start with you. We're going to start with a Republican, in quotes, maybe, Wendell Willkie, his presidential run in 1944. An interesting case here, both party-wise and also in his outcome. Tell us about the primary and Wendell Willkie.
So Wendell Willkie, he was a lawyer, and he had worked with a lot of utility companies throughout the 1930s, and he had been basically a Democrat. And he ran in the 1940 election, and he did very, very well. He lost to FDR in the end, but it didn't really dispel his presidential hopes. And so he decided that he was going to run again. But between 1940 and 1944, things kind of changed. World War II was going on. The Republicans didn't really want to get involved, but Willkie thought it was a good idea for us to get involved. And so he decided he was going to run for office as a Republican, though, as you said, in quotation marks, because he had really been a Democrat and he saw an opportunity in the Republican Party. And so he basically staked his entire political career on the 1944 Wisconsin primary.
And why Wisconsin?
Not very many states at that time actually had primaries, and primaries were a way for candidates who were not very popular with the party leadership to prove that they were popular with the people. And so Willkie thought, hey, I did great in Wisconsin in 1940. He basically won the entire state with the exception of the Milwaukee area, so he thought, I'm just going to go back there. People in Wisconsin love me. So he traveled around the state campaigning. It didn't really go as well as he thought, though large numbers of people came out to see him. Our Republican governor wasn't that impressed with him. The state Republican Party decided not to endorse him. And so it really did seem like Willkie had a chance, though, because he was so popular at these rallies. But by the time the election actually came around in April of that year, he ended up losing and losing badly. He was out of the race, and he kind of ended his political career. Something else that kind of happened during his time in Wisconsin is that he developed a throat infection that kind of plagued his campaign and eventually leads to his death before the general election that year. So being a candidate can be harmful for many reasons.
It's a rough road. Yeah, we've been hearing the horse candidates this election cycle. We're at the point where they are. Their voices are starting to give out, and this is really a cautionary tale.
Absolutely. I mean, I wouldn't say that all of our candidates are destined Willkie's fate to die of this kind of cardiac event that was precipitated by his throat infection. But it was his time in Wisconsin and the constant campaigning that really led to his ill health.
Well, Scott, we're going to turn to you now, and we're going to talk about JFK's run in 1960. Set the stage for us. What was it like when he was campaigning here?
So, you know, he kind of did a lot of things that at the time were fairly new, like having an in-house pollster that, you know, worked for the campaign. And of course, you know, during the 1960 election, he was famous for, you know, his effective use of television, especially in the debates against Richard Nixon later. But in the primary election, one of the big things that he was trying to accomplish was to basically show people that anti-Catholic sentiment would not, you know, sink a Catholic candidate. And so he was really counting on Wisconsin and other states to demonstrate that. And in Wisconsin, he won, but the vote was sort of more divided along kind of neatly religious lines. But in West Virginia, which is more heavily Protestant, he also won. And that's considered a pretty significant step for him.
So there was this religious aspect to his time here, but he was also, he's pioneering in the way that he used the media and allowed access to the media. What was that like for him?
Well, for one thing, he allowed access to a documentary filmmaker named Robert Drew, who created a film called Primary, and that's considered sort of an influential political documentary. And, you know, it was also interesting because at the time, you know, we hadn't yet developed this extensive season of open primaries and closed primaries and caucuses in every state. So Wisconsin was kind of relatively early on. And in fact, you know, at the time, you could still be a viable candidate and not necessarily actually participate in these primaries. Lyndon Johnson, who, you know, at the time was also in the Senate and also was trying to get the nomination, you know, he didn't bother with the Wisconsin primary. He just, you know, counted on being able to get enough delegates at the convention.
Erica, you're nodding your head. Did you want to add something about the earliness?
Well, I was just going to say that Wendell Willkie actually didn't participate in any primaries in 1940 either, and he easily won the Republican nomination. So I think it just shows that the primary and the importance of it is kind of a more recent development, just because a lot of states didn't really have it. And so, you know, all the excitement and attention that we pay to it now is kind of a more recent thing.
So not only didn't you have that many opportunities to partake in primaries, the Wisconsin was actually considered, I guess, sort of early back then. And so, Scott, let's go back to you. So how did that Kennedy turn in 1960, how did that change the way that campaigns are run today?
Well, I mentioned polling for one thing. And, you know, he certainly wasn't the first candidate to have, you know, to have a pollster in his employ. But it became a lot more common after that election. And so, you know, there's a lot of people who kind of think his, you know, his campaign's approach in the primary and the general election in 1960 kind of informed the way that modern political campaigns operate. You know, obviously he had a lot of money to draw on, being from a wealthy family in the race, and so that allowed him to do things like hire pollsters and, you know, buy a lot of TV spots and things like that.
We're talking right now with Scott Gordon and Erica Janik, both WPR colleagues here. Erica Janik is a producer for Wisconsin Life as well and a historian. And we're talking about the role of Wisconsin in the primaries throughout history. And Scott, we're going to stick with you. Tell us about Jimmy Carter and his time in the state in the 1976 primary. What was happening at the time to set the stage for that primary?
Well, at the time, the Democrats were getting ready for a very crowded primary season with a lot of people trying to get the nomination. And part of this was, you know, people wanted to seize the moment of kind of going after a weakened a Republican Party in the wake of Watergate and Nixon's resignation and things like that. And Jimmy Carter actually spoke to this panel of journalists in La Crosse in 1975, and it was actually broadcast on the regional newsmakers program out there, and you can still hear that panel discussion on their site. And the argument that he made in talking with them was that he could kind of pull together all these different threads of the Democratic Party to, you know, to create a strong opposition to this weakened GOP. You know, he talks about how he approaches civil rights and integration and tried to take a balanced approach, you know, somewhat controversial approach in Georgia as governor there. You know, he makes these kind of broad overtures to fiscal conservatism and talking about things like having a federal balanced budget, which is not something you'd hear a lot of Democrats on the campaign trail talk about today. So it's really interesting kind of what he's doing there. And, you know, I kind of wrote a little thing about it. And what I said was that you just really hear Jimmy Carter, the shrewd politician, at that news conference.
And we're going to fast forward now to 2012, the primary with Mitt Romney. And this is a rare case in recent history anyway, where Wisconsin was a big deal. Why was it? And what happened during that primary?
Well, it was kind of considered, a lot of people considered it sort of a last stand for Rick Santorum, who at that point, you know, had been Mitt Romney's closest rival throughout most of the primaries and, you know, had won some states, you know, even though throughout the campaign, Mitt Romney was kind of increasingly dismissive of his campaign. But Santorum lost in Wisconsin and then, you know, shortly after that dropped out of the race. And I think it was kind of considered a crucial turning point where the, you know, Republican electorate sort of solidified a bit more behind Mitt Romney, who, you know, was talked about as someone who, you know, Republicans were sort of hesitant to embrace in a lot of ways because he was considered more moderate and kind of less charismatic than a lot of the people who've been, you know, shaping the Republican Party for the last 8 years.
And Erica, let's bring you back in on this. Looking back through the lens of history, what strikes you when you compare the early presidential primaries with what we've got going on today?
Well, I think one of the things to keep in mind, particularly as people are voting, is that we've really only been able to vote in presidential primaries since 1912. This is a rather recent development. And I think that the importance of the primary is something that is much greater now than it was at that time. The presidential primary in Wisconsin was something that our governor, Robert La Follette, had fought for. He really made it kind of a centerpiece of his progressive campaign for the governorship. He pushed through this legislation because before that, candidates were basically picked by whoever gave the party the most money. You would just pick your friends or, you know, who promised to give you the most things. And Robert La Follette thought that this was a very corrupt system. And so he succeeded in pushing through a state referendum for a direct primary in 1904. And we actually had our first state primary for state-level offices in 1906. And that didn't come to the presidential stage until 1912. And so I think one of the things that's very different about the primary now, as I said, is that it just has a greater importance, that more states have these early kind of voting, whether it's a caucus or a primary. This wasn't the case in the early part of the 20th century. We've really only had a voice in the early part of our election in the last few decades.
Eric and Scott, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Thanks so much.
That was Wisconsin Life producer Erica Janik and WPR colleague Scott Gordon talking about the history behind some of Wisconsin's most influential presidential primaries. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert. The produce section of your local grocery store has probably undergone a shift over the last decade. In years past, you may not have given a second thought to whether your broccoli or your apples were organic or not. But a new report from the U.S. Department of Agriculture shows that the demand for organic foods has grown so much that a record number of farms are seeking to become certified organic. There's been a 300% increase since 2002. And Wisconsin, which is known as being a farming powerhouse, is working to meet that demand. Joining us now is Margaret Crome. She's the Policy Program Director for the Michael Fields Agricultural Institute. Margaret, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
So what kind of growth has the organic farming industry seen in recent years?
Well, all over the country, it's been growing leaps and bounds, but in Wisconsin, it has as well. And we are now number two in terms of numbers of organic, certified organic farmers, and especially heavy in robust in dairy and livestock and oil seeds and grains. Those are some of our strengths, but also in vegetables. So we have a growing interest. We also have, interestingly, our organic sector is younger than most. We have most of our other sector in agriculture. You've probably heard about the problem with aging farmers. We have a problem with not enough new farmers coming in. Well, that's not true in organic agriculture. We have a profile that's more women and younger in organic. And then also we have more farmers kind of lined up to become organic in Wisconsin. We have transitional farmers that are in that 3-year, you know, zone where they have to, they can't yet be certified, but they're in the middle of doing the organic practices. We have more of those queued up to become organic farmers.
I got to ask, you said we're number two. Who's number one?
It's California.
California. Okay, well, number two, not so bad for a Midwestern state. If you're looking at the organic numbers, that seems significant. What do you think it is about Wisconsin that has got it such at the vanguard at this organic movement?
Well, there are lots of things, and maybe I'll start with one of the most obvious, which is where we're number one. You don't want to miss the chance to say that, and that's with dairy. So no big surprise. We are the cheese state. We're the dairy state. And so we are number one nationally in organic dairy. And no big surprise there, Organic Valley is a cooperative in southwest Wisconsin, western Wisconsin, that is a powerhouse nationally. And it, of course, helps a lot of farmers certify. So that's one reason. But there are really others that make Wisconsin a natural, I think. One is we have a history of livestock agriculture, and livestock agriculture tends to be more diversified. So if you're a more diversified farmer, it's easier for you to, you don't need to use pesticides in the same way. If you're a monocropping farmer, it's harder. So that in itself makes it easier. But we have a bunch of institutional reasons, one of which I'm sitting in right now, the University of Wisconsin is a very significant player. We have the, you know, Center for Integrated Agricultural Systems, which is our sustainable agricultural center on campus, but it does a lot of work all around the state. UW Extension, not, you know, many states have cut their extensions. In Wisconsin, we have not, well, we actually, unfortunately, this last budget cut extension, but we still have a robust extension program. Our county extension and our agents and our specialists in the state, that makes a difference. Our Department of Agriculture, how many states can say that they have an organic coordinator, have an organic advisory council? That's really unusual. Our technical colleges, we have several of them. Northeast Wisconsin Technical College has a program in organic agriculture. So there are lots of those things, plus, of course, our cooperative history. So we have a marketing tradition. We have a system of cooperatives that helps the growers come into it, as in Organic Valley, but also helps with the market development with our food co-ops and our community-supported agriculture and farmers markets. I mean, we've really, over the years, found a lot of synergy here in the state.
What is the process like to become organic certified? You mentioned a transitional period. What does that whole scope look like?
Well, it is. That's one of the impediments to coming into organic agriculture, because it's very common for somebody going into organic to experience a drop in yields at the front end. And your land has to be 3 years without any of the synthetic pesticides that organic prohibits. And if it's been accustomed to that, and you've been accustomed to that, you're apt to see yield drops. And during that period, you still don't get the benefit of an organic premium price. So you're apt to struggle, and it can be a tough process. You're certified by having a certifying agency go through a very comprehensive process with you, checking what kinds of inputs you use, looking over all of your records. The really interesting questions that people ask having to do with your soil management and your pest management. And you go through that process. Fortunately, we have real assets, not just the ones I mentioned, but we have, Wisconsin. So you may not know this, but it's kind of fun to me that around the country, in fact, all over the world, there is no single place that's hotter in organic than La Crosse, Wisconsin, the last weekend in February. It is the largest organic farming conference in the world.
Really?
Absolutely. It's sponsored, run by the Midwest Organic Sustainable Education Services, known as MOSES. And, you know, people all over the country say, oh, you're going to go to MOSES this year. I mean, it's a huge draw internationally and nationally. And we have those kinds of resources. And the Michael Fields Agricultural Institute, and I'm proud to say we do a lot of research. We do a lot of education. I do policy work. So we have an apparatus that's built up to help farmers go through this process, not to mention all of the organic research. We have a distinction in Wisconsin. We just got the first in the nation endowed chair in organic plant breeding. How about that?
A lot of resources here in Wisconsin, right? We're talking right now with Margaret Crome, Policy Program Director for the Michael Fields Agricultural Institute, and she's talking with us about the increased demand for organic foods nationwide and how Wisconsin is meeting that demand. Seems to be booming. We're number two in the nation. Why do you think there is this demand for organic food in not just Wisconsin, but in the nation? What are we seeing?
Well, I think it's a product of a lot of things. I think a number of people, partly it's a result of more transparency in the food system. I think as people get to know, as there are more farmers markets, and as there are more community-supported agriculture systems, and as there are more cooperatives, you know, food co-ops, people actually want to know more about their food. And the more they know, the more they would like to have more control over what they are consuming. One of the virtues of the organic standards is it lets you know what's there. I mean, part of the reason organic is grown is a lot of people don't want genetically modified organisms. You've heard that big fight just in the last few months. That's something that you can control if you buy organic, because you're not allowed to use GMOs if you are an organic farmer. That's part of the label. And so there are a number of things. People are concerned about food safety. Lots of people are concerned about what it does to the environment. A lot of people are glad to support farmers getting a higher price. So there are a number of reasons why consumers support organic. Those are some, not all. But a lot of it, I think, is a desire to protect the health, especially of kids. A lot of parents, I know, personally, anecdotally, I know an awful lot of people who said, well, I never particularly cared when I was a college student, but now I got kids, and now I'm wanting to. I mean, I've seen some of the research largely comes out of Europe and other countries. We don't have as robust a research apparatus, and that tends to, well, I won't malign any of the research in this country, but I'll say that other countries with very rigorous research have shown some real concerns with health risks with pesticide exposures.
And what about the cost of organic food? Because it tends to be more expensive than food that is conventionally produced, may have some pesticides, is not certified organic, and therefore, you know, it might not be accessible to everybody. It can be something that is only for the upper tiers of socioeconomic classes. Do you worry about that?
You know, one of the things that I love about this last 20 years in working in this area is everybody I know worries about that. No one takes that as a small matter. From the very beginning in the Madison area CSA coalition, now called Fair Share CSA coalition, from the very outset, people were concerned about having access for low-income consumers. Many of the food co-ops do. There are lots of programs to help address that, because if it's important for me, I want it to be accessible to anybody. And that's a very common sentiment. And so there are lots of strategies that people have set up to address that, some nationally, some state, some local. So nationally, in the most recent farm bill, for example, passed 2 years ago, there was a program typically called the Double Bucks program. Basically, if you are a SNAP recipient, a food stamp recipient, and you can go to the farmer's market around Madison area, Dane County, for instance, you go to the market and you can get up to $25 per day of your fruits and vegetable purchases doubled. You can double that amount. Now, that doesn't say you have to be organic, but it allows you to purchase organic. There are a lot of HMOs that, and you know, health care groups that are offering incentives for purchasing fresh fruits and vegetables. And again, you can choose with that extra to purchase organic. There are what's called environmental benefit transfers. So it's basically a mechanism that you can go to a farmer's market or store and you can use your SNAP voucher there. And that makes it easier for you to have access. There's several of these. And of course, a lot of co-ops actually have systems to make it easier.
We're talking with Margaret Crome right now, Policy Program Director for the Michael Fields Agricultural Institute. And we're talking about the big demand for organic foods nationwide. It's grown 300% since 2002. Talking about how Wisconsin fits into that picture. And we're taking your calls about organic food. Do you shop organic? Do you farm organic? Would you like to see more organic products at the grocery store? And do you think organic food is accessible to everybody, or is it a luxury item? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We're continuing our conversation about the explosive growth in the demand for organic foods and how that's shaping the agricultural industry nationwide and here in Wisconsin. We're joined now by Margaret Crome. She's the Policy Program Director for the Michael Fields Agricultural Institute. And we're taking your calls, too, at 800-642-1234. Do you shop for organic food? Do you think it's getting more accessible to everyone, or do you think it's still out of reach for consumers and we need to do better on that? Do you think it's good for farmers in Wisconsin? Call 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll take our first caller. We've got Peter on the line in Madison. Peter, hi.
Hi. My question dealt with the feasibility of actually turning all farming into organic. I mean, if it's good in a little bit, then the logic would hold that we all should be turning organic. On the other hand, it's my understanding that if all farming was organic, we wouldn't sustain the world. The world would starve. one of the reasons that we're able to feed the world is because of proper management and acreage production allows us to produce more, and organic just simply isn't sustainable to feed the world.
Peter, thanks a lot for that question. And Margaret, what do you say to that, that the organic is not enough when you have so many people in need of food in the world?
Well, it's a great thought, and it's a very common perception. I would say, first of all, in terms of the work that Michael Fields Agricultural Institute does and the work that I do, I work with farms across a wide spectrum. I love working with farmers who are wanting to protect their soil, conserve their soil, keep the water, the nutrients on their ground, reduce their pesticides, and they don't have to be organic for me to be thrilled to work with them. And I think that's one of the strengths in our state is that we have a wide spectrum, and that's a good thing. However, to your specific question, I'd say, yeah, I think that you're right at the moment. If organic as it is right now with the amount of investment that's been placed in organic research, which is a very small amount relative to the other kind of research, and with the other kinds of subsidies that have supported mainstream and conventional agriculture compared to organic, it's true that at this moment, it really, really, I think it's a fair point. But it's also fair to say that organic has struggled mightily and has grown despite the infrastructure which has supported its competition, and yet it is growing and surviving as we have more research to support it, as we have more institutional support, better crop insurance support, better national sorts of subsidies, transportation subsidies, marketing subsidies, all the subsidies that the rest of agriculture enjoys, will be able to find some of its costs coming down and efficiencies captured.
Peter, appreciate that call, and we're going to go next to Harriet in Gays Mills. Hi, Harriet.
Hi. I've been a certified organic farmer since 1989, and I have to say that over time I have found that organic farming has made my farm more productive. Year after year, the more I follow organic production practices, and it makes me less reliant on outside input, so my economic bottom line is better, too, because I don't have to buy many pesticides anymore. I don't have to buy outside fertility inputs because I've learned how to do this with cover cropping and crop rotation and putting in native planting so I have beneficial insects. And what they – it just – I've seen it on my farm, and just the soil tilth and health. Every year, we can't believe it, but it just gets better and better.
Harriet, appreciate that call. And Margaret, Harriet, painting a picture of organic farming that becomes richer and easier to sustain as she goes along and learns about the practices and reaps some of the benefits. Is that typical, or is this something that can be difficult?
Well, it can be difficult, but it isn't unusual. I mean, I think that a lot of farmers find that because organic agriculture and more broadly sustainable agriculture is management intensive as opposed to purchased inputs intensive, it's as you get more aware of the variables, you can capture a lot of benefits. And, you know, a lot of organic farmers and sustainable ag farmers have found that as we have increasing climate problems and we have extreme weather, drought, extreme floods, having that rich investment in your soil, which is an absolute foundational point with organic agriculture, means that the water goes into the soil, it retains better. So you find lots and lots of studies over many years have shown that organic agriculture is able to have better yields in tough years. So that can actually, it's a form of resilience in our state's agriculture.
We're talking right now about the boom in the demand for organic food with Margaret Crome, Policy Program Director for the Michael Fields Agricultural Institute. And another quick call here from Pat in Holman. Pat, hello.
Hi, how do you do?
Good, thanks.
I just wanted to say that I've been a long-time organic food consumer, and that my income is not in the high level. I am now a senior citizen, but I've been buying organic for a long time. And I'm not on SNAP, but I do qualify for fuel assistance in the wintertime. And that it is possible, if you shop smartly, that you can get a good organic diet without breaking the bank.
All right, Pat, thanks for that. And what do you think about her comments? Does that paint a picture that you think is accurate about the way people are able to access food if they know about the resources now?
Yeah, I think a good part of it has to do with education. Of course, we're finding that across the food system, that a lot of people haven't really gotten into the habit of thinking about what they eat, how they invest their money. And so I'm happy to hear that from Pat, and I think that there are a lot of consumers like that. Great shopping.
All right, Pat, appreciate your call. And Margaret, where do you see the organic food industry going in the next couple of years? We've seen this kind of record growth here, 300% since 2002, but just briefly, what would you say you see on the horizon?
Well, I'm sure there's going to be continued growth. There's no reason to not assume it. And I have to say the largest part of agricultural investments is making the same assumption. There's money coming into organic agriculture because it's growing. And it's been growing now for 20 years, and there's no reason to think it will stop. Hopefully, it will become more diverse, and we'll find increasing structures to help make it easier for farmers.
So you see growth on the horizon, even though it's been 20 years growing.
It's been 20 years growing, more than. And yeah, and there's no doubt it's going to continue to grow. I mean, no, I don't think there's anybody who's making monetary investments who doesn't assume the same.
All right. Well, we'll keep watching it. I'm sure it's going to be something to watch here in Wisconsin. And when did you say the La Crosse Moses Festival is?
It's the last weekend in February. And you can always look up Moses Organic. And you'll find it. It's one of the most robust, 3,600 attendees this past year. We kind of squeeze ourselves in there. It's really powerful. And very diverse farmers of all stripes and sizes and kinds come to that conference.
Well, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
That was Margaret Crome, Policy Program Director for the Michael Fields Agricultural Institute, talking about the boom in organic food nationwide and, of course, here in Wisconsin as well.